if we are gods, how can it be that there's any spiritual authority outside our own persons?
I think that's an incredibly important question to ask for the want of another question. How do we corroborate our own experience as individuals?
Leads to another question, too. Are we all equal if we're all gods?
We can play with that one, Ryan. But I rather like this idea. If we're each gods, and therefore we are each our own independent spiritual authority, you know, basically I trust nobody but myself. You know, how do I find knowledge in another? How do I make that kind of connection with the holy guru on one side, assuming that there is one to make a connection with him? And at the same time, how do I begin? You know, I've just had this spiritual experience. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you're growing up and you try to validate your experiences with your peers, you know, and you talk about things. In magic, we're trying to find a way to corroborate and validate experience so that it's just not some kind of psychic game. You know, so on the Tree of Life itself, with the AA grades being based, the modes of consciousness that the Sephiroth talk about, these are corroborated by certain experiences you have when bringing your mind to that grade, to that level of experience, of awareness.
Two questions to my mind.
Say that, Cammie, again.
One is, I was saying that this brings up two questions to my mind. First, how do you recognize somebody else's spiritual authority? And I would say, as far as at least like your grade that you're at, you can tell because there's some objective truth to where there are certain results on the higher planes, and you can tell from things like the integrity of that person and the work they've done. And then the other question is, well, do you really need a spiritual authority? And I would say the difference between the Western and the Eastern systems is that the East puts much more emphasis on it, and they say you need a guru. But in the West, they say it's pretty optional. I mean, at first you want one, just like you would have somebody teaching you how to swim. There are different ways to swim and so on. But as you become more self-reliant, then you become basically your own teacher.
And as a result, we have a lot more inventiveness in the Western occult history than we do in Eastern occult history.
But, you know, for me,
Eastern occult history, they place a lot of value on external authority and tradition. Where in the West, I believe we place more on individual innovation. And it's why in the West, they have so many broken lineages. There's no real continued lineage in many magical traditions. There are always offshoots and schisms. To a much more significant degree than most traditions.
And most important, Ryan, it becomes incumbent on us that we each generation define its relationship with the divine in its own terms, with the world in constant change. That relationship is also constantly changing. Eastern lineages do not account for that. You're still fighting the same old sword battle that the samurai fought in an age of tanks and remote-controlled killing machines.
Well, what Ryan said as far as sectarianism, you know, it seems more divisive, but it's an improvement over investing all spiritual authority onto one person, whether that's a guru or perhaps a certain epoch that's that's so in the distant past, a time gone by.
Hey, look, it produces more creativity and diversity. And if you look at the two cultures, say, especially if you go to the extreme of authority, Japan versus North America and Europe, Japan is great at improving things and doing things well according to instructions, where Europe and North America create many more things. This contrast on the spiritual plane even seems to echo itself on both the artistic and industrial planes as well.
I noticed a lot in the East that they have this huge emphasis on respecting your elders and your teachers. They have this their own ideas about honor, and they have a lot of modesty and humility where they don't want to have any pride for themselves and what they've done.
Yeah, and I see it as a big problem. I mean, it's good. I think it's good to be balanced, but the big problem is you have less people producing their own things with this high sense of modesty. And I make a joke, actually, with my English students here in Israel. I tell them the more east you go, the less important the individual is, because a lot of Israelis, they don't use capital letters for their names. And when they write I, they don't use the capital letter, because there's no such thing in Hebrew. And now when you go to China, nobody calls you by your first name. Everybody's called by their last name. It's meaning the family is your identity. So you see this shift from extreme importance on the first name to neutral importance on the first name to the first name is now almost gone. So anyways,
so as we project to outside authority, we lose our individuality, is what I hear you guys saying. And
yeah, the only authority an outside person has is their experience they can share with
you. And those shared experiences become important, because we do have to decipher between what is valid spiritual experience and what is a psychotic episode.
Yeah.
Okay? And a lot of people don't know that difference. And when you look to the East in a place like India, where they cannot tell the difference between spiritual experience and a psychotic episode, and nor do they care to tell the difference, to them, it's all a holy experience. Okay, so it's in the West that we've come to realize that sometimes it's not spiritual experience. And we have to be careful of that. So, there's that book that was going around a few years back, The Zelator. I can't think of the author who wrote it. And there was another book just like that, and I can't think of the title of it. But they were both describing certain psychic phenomena in grades of initiation. And I was standing there reading the book going, holy shit, you're right. I mean, I had parallel experiences. And for me, that was a very validating moment, where I could have still questioned myself and says, is that a psychotic experience or not? I'm seeing a validation in another person having a parallel or similar experience.
Well, I think there is a fine line between psychotic and spiritual experience. And of course, this could make a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
I remember, if I quote you, that magic is a controlled psychosis, just like a car engine is a controlled explosion.
Right.
It's not always clear which is which, but there is a certain amount of controlled psychosis.
When we reach that state of mind in a controlled manner, we develop authentic spiritual experience. And I don't want to say just controlled, but certainly a certain balanced approach. It may be a natural phenomena of mind as well. But certainly we then have that creative experience that can be very, very deep, very, very profound, very authentic. And its authentication comes in part when we realize that others who get to those same states in their consciousness have parallel experiences to that. Then we realize that this factor carries with it something more profound than it would be related to any illness.
Yeah.
Well,
because you can repeat certain processes to get to that state, and then repeat certain processes to be out of that state. But
so,
another illness, there is no process that you repeat. You're just there.
So certainly, like, say, for example, you know, the Zelator in the AA could turn to the neophyte and say, well, you know, I was there. I'm just a step further down the road. I know what you're going through. I understand what you're feeling and seeing and experiencing. The AA is the party. You know, that's the first thing that you have to realize. Okay? Because your quote unquote superior in the AA doesn't boss you around. They give you assignments or whatever. But that's all being, assignments are not being given because of some hierarchical, this is how you get instructed, see Kyle. It's more like, well, hey, these are the things that you're going through, and these are other things that can help you to better understand or better experience or in some way will better enable you in what you're going through right now. Because every AA grade is an exploration through consciousness. You're walking through a piece of your soul. You know, and we all, you know, we're all made the same, just like we have four arms and five fingers. five fingers.
did you say four arms?
Four, yeah.
Yeah. I guess we're not all made the same. I think I'm abnormal by your standards.
You see, I live next to this nuclear power plant. You know.
So what's the difference between mental illness and psychotic episodes? And
there's a difference between mental illness and merely being stoned, okay? four limbs, I meant to say, and you know, five fingers or five digits, 10 fingers altogether, five on each end, digits, whatever you want to call them. And in that same way, our souls are constructed identically. And so therefore, you know, if I'm in the outer rim of my soul, let's just say riding the walls of it, where it meets the not me, and you go to those outer walls of your soul, well, we're going to kind of have kind of the same feelings. Just in the same way that, you know, when you feel joy, you know, and I feel joy, we both experience the same thing inside our head. It's the same chemicals dumping themselves in our head going, okay, time to be happy now, jump up and down. You know?
We mentioned earlier about the fact that some people can lose their spiritual authority. They can lose their creativity and putting out new gnosis. So when you're trying to find, like, say, an AA teacher, I don't think it can be said that you can lose your voice if you haven't found it yet. But you know what you're looking for. And then that person, you know, they seem to corroborate what you're looking for or your experiences. And then, in the case of certain people, like in the caliphate or the OTO, if they no longer seem like they're putting out any new gnosis, then you move on.
Well, yeah, you may do that. But I mean, like with every kind of partner we choose in our lives, I don't care if it's business partner, lover, guru, what have you. We do not choose in rational and reasonable ways. In other words, life brings us by the law of attraction. And the law of attraction is not a law written with pen and paper. You know, it's a, we can call it an invisible law, but it's certainly a law that is meta-rational, meta-reasonable, irrational. And, you know, I look at my own journey, and I met up with some kooks. You know, I was thinking about probably, I don't know, I mean, in the early days of questing to find spiritual teachers, this one guy, Harry Loring Flowers, who later went to court and changed his name to Volcar. Now, he was trying to convince me that he was, like, dealing with the next spiritual step in human evolution, and he was getting transmitted messages from these extraterrestrial beings, and he was writing term papers for them.
And, so he accomplished that by changing his name?
Well, the whole thing is that, like, this is a guy that, you know, in my early days of college, I'm stumbling into something. I'm looking for something. And so I stumble on this guy. He actually introduces me to the Aleister Crowley deck, because that's the deck he uses in a card reading for me. And that starts me on my journey. So,
but it's always like this. That person that seems like the wrong person quite often introduces us to things that turn out the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, all the experience that followed and all the severals that I met, you know, until the days I actually got into Thelema and everything else, and then all that I've met and followed in there. A lot of them were definitely quacks, man. And Volcar is just one of the candidates. But
you've told me some stories.
Yeah, there's plenty of stories I could sit around and tell. But despite all that, each set me up somewhere positive. Each opened a door, though they didn't themselves do it, but for my experience with them, that it was able to be done. And so I find my journey, and you know, the same way that when somebody comes up to us and says, well, you know, I want to join your lineage of the AA, you don't join lineages in the AA, okay? You get offered an instructor, and you either click with that instructor or you don't click. And if you don't click, that's the law of attraction. So to say that, you know, you should investigate this and that lineage, and they should produce one new noses, have really, really cool girls, and good drugs. It's not a formula that you follow. You know, it's the law of attraction will get there. There's nothing for us to do but light the lamp. And we're all trying to light our own lamp anyway. That's what we're trying to do. And as you light the lamp, you'll attract some flies. After a while, you'll get more than flies. With the three schools of magic, the yellow school, the black school, and the white school, we're in the white school of magic. No matter, and we've done our fair share of ragging on the yellow and the black schools. We're, you know, Stellamites and in charge of the Great White Brotherhood. We're not really into those two schools. However, it's the yellow school that assisted the white school in recovering from the damage the science did to us. There's a lot of camaraderie to go on between Blavatsky and Crowley, as exponents each Crowley of the white school and Blavatsky of the yellow school.
So the yellow school is like the Eastern school with Buddhism?
Well, certainly it doesn't have to be just the Eastern school, because we would put the Taoists in the white school.
Yeah, right? That's for sure. And knowing that, I would say that there are even different schools of magic within a religious tradition. I mean,
yes,
look at Chan or Zen Buddhism. It's very different from other forms, and I would say it goes into the white school category.
Yeah.
So East and West is the simplest way to first approach it. But then afterwards we have to start realizing that there are exceptions.
Yeah, that it breaks down into these three forms anyway. And yet, at the table of adepts, you know, at the table of the feast, the wedding table, or whatever you want to call it, the College of the Rose Cross, where the adepts of all three schools sit together, there's certainly a very different perspective. So that when we look for spiritual authority, and we begin to find voices that lean to one school or the other, that's one thing, of course, that belongs to this world. And that's already a rational, metalogical, metaphysical.
Well, the thing is it depends on the planes, on the lower planes, like the physical, lower astral plane. Three schools are separate, but above the abyss, and even on some of the higher intellectual planes, the three schools meet together, at least the adepts of the three schools meet together. Because let's face it, the schools externally are nothing but arbitrary customs and symbols meant to lead us to a specific place. And if each school has any genuine authority, they should all lead to the same place, in the end, which should be the city of the pyramids.
So
you say that all of the three schools are necessary?
Well, I mean,
me personally, inevitable, that's for sure.
Yeah, inevitable, existential, they're there, they simply are. And that's all the validation they need.
Can you just give me a definition of the black school?
The black school would be similar to the yellow school in that it finds a certain negation in value for this world. But the black school causes this world to be evil, whereas the yellow school just says this world is not as important as the other world.
The black school dividing people up in slaves and masters.
In a certain sense, I would say yes, but I would say that's more the white school.
Especially if you read Nietzsche, who I would say is the prophet of the white school.
Yeah,
go ahead. Don't confuse the black school with the black brothers and the black law, which they're not the same thing.
Yeah, remember that, Brian. You're very correct there. Don't confuse the black lodge with the black school of magic. Black school of magic is a very legitimate school of magic. Okay, all it's saying is that that which is spiritual is holy and profound, and that which is material is unholy and evil, ugly.
Yeah.
Okay. The yellow school is saying this world has mixed attractions of good and evil. Beautiful and ugly, but that this world doesn't count. It's an illusion. The black school still, this world is real. This world still counts in the black school. In the yellow school, this world doesn't count. It's Maya.
What's the black school again as far as the
example, Christianity belongs to the black school. Okay.
It probably claims that in the beginning Christianity was an emanation of the white school, but became perverted by the black brothers, and then it became the black school somehow. At least that's how I think he mentioned that.
There was a perversion of, again, the black school, it would still be legitimate to some degree.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. But in its perversion, it becomes illegitimate. The teaching of the age, of the Piscean age even, the spiritual age, there's three cycles of humanity. And we experience these cycles in terms of thousands of year cycles, 500 year cycles, decade long cycles. And these three cycles, we could call them the spiritual, the material, and the integrated. Now, in a spiritual cycle, you find value in everything that is in heaven, everything that is spiritual in the skies becomes holy, and everything down here has no value. In a material cycle, only those things that can appeal to my five senses. It's a scientific age. It's very material. There is no such thing as spiritual. If we can't detect it and perceive it, then it doesn't exist. In the integrated age, and this is very thelemic, we find both above and below to be holy.
So this correlates also with the three schools of magic, then?
Well, in a certain sense, yes, but no.
But the three schools have always existed in each age. I mean, Taoism, for instance, has existed for, you know, a few thousand years.
Yeah, the ages themselves, well, the descriptions of the ages don't describe the schools.
But the age represents a formula which is in harmony with a specific school. Like this age, the predominating magical formula is in harmony, more harmony in some ways with the white school. Whereas the Aeon of Osiris, it was more in harmony with the black school. Because in Osiris, you have to die, meaning you have to kill and forsake the material to experience the spiritual. In my opinion.
Well, and that's exactly right. So the formulas are different. You know, in sacrificing the material to the spiritual, you have the black school. You have you find out that Osiris is a black god.
A question might be because Crowley and Ptolemaic claim that all legitimate schools have to follow the new formula of the new eon. So then the question, it begs the question, do the other two schools, if they're legitimate, have to at some level acknowledge the formula of the new eon?
Well,
though they might have their own way of interpreting it.
Crowley doesn't say that new schools have to conform to the Vibarao. He says that new prophets, new gnosis, must not contradict Vibarao, must be in conformity with. And so...
Okay, but Moda...
But that would be...
Moda
that,
adds...
Yeah, Ryan.
Moda
would,
adds... And, sorry.
Ryan, that would then be that we as Thelemites can recognize it. But just because we can't recognize something doesn't mean it isn't.
Yes.
Okay, and I think
what about Moda, who says that everybody who wears traditional religious clothes is in fact a demon incarnate? It's a very extreme statement. What it's referring to is that denying the new formula, and they're following a clefotic path, a path that's not connected with reality anymore.
Well, I mean, but that's not related, really, to what where we're going here with that. I mean, Moda's always good at saying very wild things. And sometimes you can be too terse, sometimes you can be right. But here, we're not talking about somebody pretending to be something else.
Right. Okay. All right, so I'll leave that maybe for another discussion.
Yeah.
So when it comes to these three schools of magic, does the secret chiefs have some sort of authority or ministering over them?
Well, in a sense, that's what we were just discussing here. The fact that, if there's three schools of magic sitting at the table of adepts, well, those three schools are, you know, let's just say it's a table of three very distinct men. Okay? Well, they're each sending out their emanations, and so their prophets are moving into the world and through the world. But are we in the white school going to recognize the black or the yellow adept? Is the yellow adept going to recognize the white or the black adept? Probably not in all cases. Okay, and the reason for that being is that we can only corroborate that which is within our own perspective, our own sphere of awareness. It takes all kinds of spheres of awareness. We as Thelemites and as any spiritual group should not try to protect...
But Crowley was able to recognize Blavatsky because not only Nada, but the master of the temple, and it seems that she's representing the Yellow School.
I think it is possible. Yeah. And I think if we're all sitting at the table of Adepts, we can all do that. But we're not.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah. Okay. So that in this outer school, we've got to recognize that we can't recognize all of the prophets in the world. We should not pretend that we have a corner on the truth. And we're the only ones that know the absolute truth. In this way, we can keep, though somewhat distant, but still respect for these other two schools that we don't belong to. On our e-group, there's plenty of times I've sat there and found every which way to mock those other two schools in a certain sense.
I agree with what you're saying. I'm glad to hear you say it, because I remember the times when you used to bash some of these other schools.
Oh, yeah, and, it's fun to do.
But I think it's important to have a respect for them, too, because yeah. They have a legitimacy in their own right.
Yeah, they have a legitimacy. These are ways for people. You know, there's 360 degrees around the mountain. Everybody's trying to get to this point at the top. But there's 360 paths you can take. So who said the path is the best path? I'm just going to keep climbing. So,
at the same time, once you pick a path, you should stick to it. Otherwise, you're going to get really good at walking around the mountain.
Yeah, never get to the top. Exactly. Yeah. But
coming back to these secret chiefs, in what way are they real? You were talking about Blavatsky being a secret chief.
Well, and Crowley calls himself ultimately a secret chief, you know, as he writes his confessions. These master works by these gods. Give to us a unique record of authentic spiritual experience, whether we're talking many of the writings of Crowley or we're talking Secret Doctrine and Isis Unveiled by Blavatsky. These masterworks reveal a knowledge that is primordial. And when you get to a point in your consciousness, because part of the spiritual path is there's a distinct stage in the spiritual path when you can see that primordial depth and you can relate it back to the contemporary moment. And when you are able to do that, you begin to see how important it is, the connection with those who came before us. And these secret chiefs ride in that connection. And the earth turns with somebody picking up the torch in all ages. We see that Eliphaz Levi picked up the torch. Barden and Barrett and Mathers and Fortune and Kroll, you know, and Rigardi and say, yeah, Cagliostro. All these people that sit in the line, and as they go on, we see more and more of that ancient history, that pre-Sumerian, whatever, The time of the Taurean Age, when the Sphinx was actually built 14,000 years ago, and you begin to feel that an emissary is coming from that time, has been carefully walking from that age then to this day now and here. Then you understand the legacy of the secret chiefs. And some of these great names leave records. They leave markers for us. They leave things to wake up or to be the match next to the candle for the next person waking up so he can light the light and get out of bed.
Yeah.
You know, and these people come along, and it's interesting. Carl Jung wrote something very profound. This is how you know that he was truly a spiritual student. He says, at some point, when you follow on the path of spirituality, you are going to have synchronicities. You are going to meet people. And these people are going to have significant impact on your work. They may come along for a moment of conversation. You may meet them, as Crowley might say, in the flesh or in the astral. Either way, all of a sudden you have these synchronistic experiences. I had two of these such experiences, so I could corroborate what he said. No, and when you have them, and that person comes along and helps you around, through, over whatever hurdle, or gives you some information you may not have even expected or didn't know you were looking for, then, you know, a doorway to your mythical imagination becomes opened. And that's the whole result of it all. So that I could even see such an emissary acting through another person who himself is just, you know, any other Tom, Dick, and Harry that just happened to be passing by.
Well, yeah, you had Rose, one of the most significant people. And you also had Eckenstein, Crowley's mountain climbing instructor, who directly taught Crowley Raja Yoga before he went to India.
Yeah. So in moments, we have all these people that you know, unlock a piece for us. You know, we see the energy of this line of people. We see that we bring ourselves through this force of attraction that is synchronous, not coincidental.
Yeah. So these meetings or these interactions with these persons or emissaries or secret chiefs, do they grant us authority, or does truth grant authority, or are they, how are they connected to truth? Is it the same thing?
Well, I mean, good questions all around. I don't know about granting authority. I would imagine in some cases, perhaps so. I mean, it seems to me, I forget his name now. The guy that came to Crowley after Crowley published the Book of Lies and inducted Crowley into the...
Theodore Royce.
He said, you published our central secret. He said, Crowley said, I don't know your central secret, so how could I have published it? And then, you know, he starts granting authority, Crowley all this authority, that ultimately creates a schism in the order and the long history of what the OTO is today. Or is not, or whatever. I don't know if I want to go so far there and say that Royce becomes a secret chief, but he certainly becomes some sort of emissary because he opens up a whole world of creativity for Crowley. Not that he himself opens it up, but Crowley has this marvelous synchronous experience. He says, just then I realized, holy shit, blah, 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 everything I've been, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of explosive aha experience that, that opens up creativity. These are the moments. You know, for me, you know, I could call it one large experience that walked in two rides. It started with you know, I tell this story on the website if you go in the right places. You know, at one point, I'm hitchhiking in Florida, and a guy picks me up on the ride home, and we're just talking the weather here. There's no reason for him to assume anything about me. And he immediately starts telling me how the cancer's been cured. He works in a laboratory that's trying to cure cancer. And he says he thinks they just have him chasing on a wild goose chase because they've already solved the problem. It's just that it doesn't make the money. It's too easy to cure cancer. I don't know why he felt he had to tell me that. But in my mind and my ruminations around that time, I had come to across an interesting quote that was resonating in my head, and I didn't know what to do with it. Cancer is a misfiring in the human effort to physically evolve. That's what's in my mind at the time. And he's telling me about this. So I don't know what to do with this. I don't know where to go with this. The internet is not super huge yet. But now it's about 3 years later. And I'm selling pianos. I'm working basically 10 days a month. I go into a Costco for 10 days. I make my money for the month. I'm in this Costco one morning. They just opened up. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm standing at my pianos here. And some guy walks over and spends about 45 minutes talking about his old Baldwin in his house. I know that he's not going to buy anything. And I'm just, you know, happy for the pleasant conversation. I'm having a nice morning here. And he turns around at the end of the conversation and says, "I want to thank you. You knew I wasn't going to buy a piano from you, and you took the time to talk to me, tell me all about this, give me all this rich information anyway. And that was a very generous thing for you to do, and I really, really appreciate it. So I'm going to give you an answer that you really need. This is going to answer a lot of your questions." He says, "I want you to write this word down." And I write down the word phosphorylation. He says, "I want you to write," he spells it for me carefully. And he says, "I'm a medical artist, and you need to understand what phosphorylation is." And he walks away, and I never see him again. It solves all my questions on cancer. It is responsible for the Gnostic Church of Light documents, all in of its own accord.
And that's really obvious in and of itself, just him saying that.
And the fact that he gave it to you with one word is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Not surprising.
The way that that sometimes we say that to do magic, you got to be nuts to begin with.
Uh-huh.
But remember that nuts are nutritious. They're good for
you. Nuts are nutritious. Okay.
Actually, there was a quote I wanted to add in one of the earlier discussions, but we were out of time. It was Marcia Eliade. He wrote a book on shamanism. It's called Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. And there's one point in the book where he says, when talking to a shaman, I asked, "What's the difference between a mystical adept and an insane person?" And the shaman told him that the shaman or adept swims in the cosmic ocean. In that case, drowns.
Wow.
That's cool.